Let's go out to the ball game, boys.
Why yeah, that's a good idea. Idea.
Why ask me that at all?
Yes, here we go. We're gone.
Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf. I'm your host, Ron Kaplan. Please visit us at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf.com for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews on baseball books and other media. Welcome back, everybody. Happy New Year. If this was a television show, I guess you'd say we were on hiatus for a while. But we're back, and hopefully this year we'll be able to bring you the Baseball Bookshelf podcast on a much more regular basis. There are a lot of great books coming out in 2011, and I know there are a lot of authors out there who will be very happy to share their stories of creation and publishing with us. Last year, we saw a great bunch of baseball biographies, including books on Hank Aaron, Roger Maris, Willie Mays. Well, today we're going to be talking with Jane Levy, author of one of those biographies, The Last Boy, Mickey Mantle, and the End of America's Innocence. I first discovered Jane from her novel in 1990, Squeeze Play, which was the story of a female sports writer covering a Major League Baseball team and all the stories that ensue from there. She has since gone on to publish perhaps the definitive biography, Sandy Koufax, A Lefty's Legacy, and now she's taking a turn with her own childhood favorite, Mickey Mantle. I had a chance to talk with Jane a few weeks ago, and here is our conversation.
When you appear at book signings or speaking engagements, what would you say is the age demographic?
Well, I think it's largely boomers.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, the Mickey generation. What I'm constantly astonished by, however, is, yes, I guess a predictable, I was there when calls, and some not so predictable, I was there when calls, like the guy who saw himself in the photo of the on the in papers.
Mm-hmm.
The one from May 30th, 1956, and said, "That's me. You see the guy in the white shirt? That's me. I was selling Dixie cups out in the right field stands. The ball went right over my head." So.
And how many people called you saying the same thing?
About the ice cream?
Yeah.
Only one guy about
Oh, really?
Ice cream. Only one ice cream guy. But I am also astonished about the number of times that some young guy or the son of some guy to whom Mantle meant so much, or some Mantle fan who wants their son, grandson, to know about him, you know, will come up and say, "Could you please sign a book for my for my son?" I'll say, "Yeah, how old is he? Oh, you know, 7 months." something like that. What I think impresses me the most, and I said this, I can't remember when, it doesn't really matter, I suppose, but I said this to somebody recently. Oh, I was talking with Neil Conan on Talk of the Nation, and, you know, they stop and ask for, you know, callers to call in. And what was striking, and there's always, you know, one or two guys like this, but what's striking with the Mantleologists is that so many of them really just want to tell you about him and what he meant to them.
Well, why
rather than asking a question.
Well, why is that? Why is it important to them to associate themselves in that way?
Well, I mean, he's a kind of locus for childhood. You know, not just for a gauzy remembered time that may have improved, you know, in the passage of time, with the passage of time, but he's one of those extraordinary figures in American culture who really rises above the temporal. He's something that people have internalized as a feeling. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, when you speak about time, where do you mark the end of America's childhood? Was it his retirement? Was it when the stories of his personal life started coming out? Was it his death? What is the end of the childhood?
Good question, Ron. I think that it's probably after his career when he began personally truly disintegrating, and when there was no more protection. No more is an exaggeration. There was still protection. I mean, no more protection from the press. His buddies and acolytes were still protecting him, and not to his advantage, I don't think. But the press was no longer protecting him. That's partly how much coverage changed, and the end of the hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil, and God knows write no evil era of sports journalism. But it's also something that, we do over and over to these guys. Everybody is happy to look the other way, as long as a quid pro quo is what I'm trying to say. Everybody's happy to look the other way to some extent. I don't think everybody thought Mickey Mantle and the Bronx Bombers were choir boys. May not have had a sense of how happy they were, for lack of a better way to put it. But certainly after the Copa, I don't think anybody thought they were choir boys. And I don't think anybody ever thought Babe Ruth was a choir boy. We just didn't know the parameters.
Well, certainly if they were performing in this day and age.
Well, let me finish this sentence.
Sure.
But I think that there is a wink and a nod that goes on. As long we'll forgive that, we'll look the other way, as long as you can still hit that ball 500 feet, as long as you can still throw a forward pass 70 yards, as long as you can still hit a drive off a tee, 300 yards or whatever is the right indice. But once you can't do it anymore, then we're really not so forgiving.
Now you're talking about that from the press point of view or the fans' point of view?
I'm talking about that from a cultural point of view.
Because certainly the fans are still in rapture with him. You write at one point, if my memory didn't match the evidence, what else might have gotten blurred by the hero worship of childhood? And there are a bunch of anecdotes in there that seem to conflict each other. He hit the ball this far, he hit the ball that far. How important was it to include all of those different versions? Or was that the point, that we all have our own memories, whether they're accurate or not?
Be a little bit more specific about which place you're talking about and what you're asking. Because what I was trying to say prior is, yes, Mantle gets more of a pass than almost anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But that as a general phenomenon, there's a handshake deal that we make with these great athletic specimens. We'll give them some rope as long as they're performing for us. But, afterwards, we're going to start to hold them to, the normal, what do you mean you're going 75 miles an hour in a 50-mile zone? Once they can't perform anymore, then people are generally less forgiving. And the extent to which Mantle was given a pass, and was much more than almost anybody, is a reflection of just how much it means to people to how much he means to people. And the sentence that you know, was the hardest for me to formulate, and it probably took me 5 years to do it. It shouldn't take 5 years to write a sentence. Is the one, you know, what, you know, I'm asking, what is this bond? You know, the question you're asking, why? Why does he mean so much? And I think finally, you know, the hard truth is that the ultimate boomer entitlement is the belief that soon to be come to a crashing halt, that, you know, we'll never get old. And that, of course, is what Mickey conveyed. That was the thing that he never, you know, expected to do. You know, and you know, Jerry Coleman's famous line, he never grew up and it ruined him. And that, to me, is at the nexus of this bond with him. And as to the specifics of the memories that contradict, which ones do you mean particularly?
No, nothing in, you know, I don't, you know, I created my list of questions, you know, a while ago. And
okay, no, sorry, yeah, I imagine. I think that, you know, memory is an interesting thing. It's trustworthy and it's not. I mean, how many of us swear, you know, that we remember a specific thing only to be contradicted by, you know, photographic evidence or somebody else's, you know, written report or whatever later, and you sit there and you go, but I remembered that. I was sure. Well, you know, like me in the chapter preface about his sweater, you know, I was sure he took it off his back and gave it to me. I was absolutely convinced. And so when I saw Bob Lipsight's interview and Mickey's wearing the sweater, now, of course, I don't know exactly when in that day it was taken, but there he is in the sweater. I started to think, well, did he take the sweater, you know, off? Well, in some ways, you know, first of all, I'll never know, you know, absent, I guess, hypnosis, which I'm not about to engage in order to find the answer to this, you know, historical query, I'll never know. But that's not the point. The point is the memory of the feeling and the reality that he made the effort on my behalf is incontrovertible. So I don't think it really matters, ultimately, you know, whether he took it off his back or not. One way or another, he got me the sweater.
Mm-hmm.
And the same, I would say, is true, for example, about the, in a slightly different context, about the two 500-foot home runs at USC. You know, I, you know, Rod Dedeau, Ralph Houk, you know, all sorts of people made it pretty clear to me that there's no way that that ball, that first home run, went 600 feet. Not saying it couldn't have gone 600 feet under particular conditions, you know, with the wind and at a different time in a different place in a different space where, you know, there were different confines and blah, 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 blah. You know, Mantle was capable of, you know, astonishing feats of strength. But to me, it didn't matter whether that ball went 590 feet or 630 feet or 530 feet. Either which way, it was an astonishing, absolutely astonishing performance. And the truth of that memory is more important to me, not necessarily to other people, than the exactitude, the need to pin down, you know, how far that ball really traveled. So, you know, it's not that memory, I mean, memory does play tricks, but, you know, the truth of the memory is often in the feeling, not in the exact numerological, you know, data.